Today, my special guest is Carolita Fuentes, originally from Chile. Carolita's been a wonderful, active community member who was instrumental in saving some land, the Steve Irwin Way forest down at the Caloundra Interchange. And she currently has an active reforestation group and has moved to Woodford in recent times, but I decided to interview Carolita today. And before we get into it, I would like to pay my respects and acknowledge that we're meeting on two lands at the moment. I'm here on Gubbi Gubbi Kabi Kabi land, and Carolita's in Jinnabarra country up at Woodford. Welcome, Carolita.
Hola. Hola, amiga. ¿Cómo estás?
Ah, that sounds so beautiful. You're speaking in Spanish, right?
Yes. Hello, how are you, I said. And thank you so much, Anna, for that beautiful introduction. It's such an honor to be interviewed with you. And we have done a little one about a year ago, which was filmed. So that was just an absolute pleasure. I think you're a really good interviewer.
Oh, thank you, darling. That was during the first round of lockdown that we had here. Yeah. And we're trying to do something to keep people, I guess, engaged and connecting with our multicultural community here on the Sunshine Coast. Well, let's just jump right in here. So you were born in Chile. Do I say that?
We say Chile.
Chile. Chile. Chile. But tell me, what was it like growing up there?
I was there till I was 4 years old, and I don't have very strong memories of what else was going on apart from the fact that my grandmother, my great aunt, were the ones who I spent most of my childhood with before we moved to Australia. They were my nannies, I suppose, because both my parents worked and they were both, just very busy professional people. So I was brought up by my Indigenous side of the family, which was from my dad's side. My great-great-grandmother was a Mapuche Pehuenche woman. We believe that she was Pehuenche because we, at the time, I don't know if you, it was the same here maybe as well, where it was actually shameful to acknowledge your Indigenous heritage, and so you would never speak about it, and you were shunned from having too many conversations about it. So the information that I have from her are just snippets that I was able to extract from my auntie and grandma, because they were also like trained under that understanding that you just didn't talk about your Indigenous heritage too much. I also understand that the region that she came from had a strong Inca influence. The Incas moved down to that part of Chile and then weren't able to move down any further. Native people of the area resisted them. So there could have been an intermarrying, intermingling pool of that met in that particular region, which was it's called the Araucanian region, which is actually where our name for the Araucaria species of trees comes from. So the Araucaria bidwillii, which is the Australian bunya, and
that's fascinating.
It is actually. And you know what's amazing about this is that the Araucaria tree has remained absolutely unchanged genetically from that time when all that landmass was together. So there was one point in time where Australia, South America and Antarctica were all one landmass called Gondwana. Mm-hmm. And that was back in about 65 million years ago, which is called the Mesozoic era, mm-hmm. which is the time of the dinosaurs, actually. So for anyone interested in those nerdy facts, you can look it all up.
A question on that. So that's, as you said, it's the bunya pines that are here.
Yes.
So in Chile, did your family eat the seeds as well?
Yes. So the Pewen tree is the Araucaria, which is the sister tree to the bunya tree. So the cones are very similar, actually. They have big round cones, not as big as the bunya ones that we have here in Australia, but and the tree is shaped slightly differently. It's shaped more like an umbrella dome on top. What we call piñones, or the bunya nuts, are more elongated, so they're smaller and more elongated, but they come out in the same kind of shape, like a big round bomb-looking, you know, fruit every couple of years. And then they, when they're opened, all the bunya nuts, all the piñones, are tightly packed together in like a pineapple sort of shape. So, yeah, they were the main source of food for the people that called themselves after that tree. So the people call themselves Pehuenches, which means the people of the Pehuen tree. Mm. Mapuche is generally the word that we use for the tribal peoples of Chile, and they divide themselves up just like here in Australia. There's different tribal and clan groups. So the Pehuenches were the people of that forest, that cold mountain forest area, which is where my grandmother said she had come from. Basically, they're called Mapuches, which means people of the earth.
Beautiful. Mapu
means earth, and Che means people. Aww. So for them, it's very simple. They're just people of the earth, and they're actually very, very, very quiet sort of people. They don't seem to talk much, and they're very humble people. They just get on with their things. They tend not to, you know, meddle in other people's business, and don't really like other people meddling with theirs. So they don't actually like even the Chilean people. They seem to sort of separate themselves a bit. Spanish descendants that came.
Wow, it's so interesting, culture and people and community. What do you remember as a little one? And I know when you were four, you came to Australia, four or five, but you went back a number of times, like back to your home country. What do you remember was there for you when you were growing up?
Yes, it was a very, very, very strong contrast of cultures. And, I mean, the big culture shock initially for me was coming to Australia. And then, obviously, my parents had massive culture shock. Like especially my mum. My dad actually integrated very easily and didn't end up going back to Chile for about 20 years afterwards, I think it was. My mum was very, very homesick for her family and her, you know, just everything, the foods, the music, the, you know, her sisters and her parents who were alive at the time. And so every couple of years, she would actually take us at the end of the year for a whole summer, actually. So it was every 2 or 3 years we'd go back and spend the entire summer in Chile, which was including sometimes February as well. That's when the kids start school in Chile. So a lot of the time I'd miss the whole of the first part, you know, the first month of school, because I'd be in Chile with my mum and my sister as well after when she came along. So
what was that like when you were there?
So when we came to Australia, we actually came to Australia because we were escape Pinochet regime that had been installed at that time. There had been a big coup d'etat military takeover in Chile. And so we came to Australia to avoid all the ensuing problems that were going to happen from having a dictatorship government. And so I grew up in a very peaceful place in a suburb in Melbourne, and we managed to avoid, you know, that. But in the times that I did go back to Chile, the poverty was very stark to me. Like there was a very, very different culture over there. For example, young children with no shoes and with clothes that were way too big or torn would sometimes come to the door knocking and asking for dry bread. And so they'd go from door to door, you know, but of course, you know, people would give them fruit and whatever they could give them. And so my family were actually always had things extra to give to the kids when they would come to the door. So whether it be hand-me-down clothes, fruit or vegetables. The first time it happened, I was utterly shocked. I had never seen that in Australia as a seven-year-old, you know, when I first went back to Chile.
And what was it like outside of the house? Like, what was the house like that you were in, and, you know, that some of those things? What was home like there?
Yeah. very much Spanish style homes where I don't know if you've been to Spain, but they're made almost like caves, so in order to keep the heat out and the heat in. Mm-hmm. They were very high ceiling homes with like adobe plaster. And the other difference that really stood out to me was that the windows that faced the street had bars, and also most homes had some kind of type of like barbed gate or fence, because obviously when a country gets thrown into poverty and there's no such thing as Centrelink or, you know, social welfare systems, people get desperate and they'll do anything they can to survive. So in the city especially, it was just normal to have bars on the windows around your house, and that was just considered, you know, normal.
Was that a large city?
Yes, so Santiago is the
Santiago.
Capital.
Santiago, you were there.
Yes, it's the capital of Chile, and that's where most of my family were living. So as you might know from other cultures as well, the extended family is quite important. Aunties and uncles and cousins and, you know, the grandparents from the different both sides, a lot of communication and a lot of visiting going on in the family. So, yeah, I suppose families tend to try and move where they can stay close together, I suppose. Mm. And so, yeah, you get to go from one house to the next. Like, you have lunch or the main meal of the day in one house, and then you'll go and have supper at another person's house, and then you'll have people over yourself, you know, the following day. So shared meals were actually one of the other things that really, really big, big contrast to here in Australia, where in the middle of the day there was time taken out to have a sit-down proper, what we would call dinner here. So the shops would close, all the workers would come home, the kids would come home from school, and everyone would sit down together about 1 o'clock or 1:30, two-course or three-course dinner in the middle of the day, and then you'd have some time to rest or even have a siesta before everything opened up again at 4 o'clock. And I'm talking about offices and shops, everything would just go quiet and stop, you know, between, I suppose, 1:30 and 3:30 roundabout, or even up to 4 o'clock. It was so great. It was so, like, just what happened was that you'd avoid the heat of the day because we were there during the summer period. So that was one thing that was just lovely, to be able to avoid that heat of the middle of the day where you weren't expected to do anything.
That's Spanish influence.
That's exactly, you're exactly right. That was leftovers from the Spanish culture, who were the ones who colonized Chile. So originally, it was the same thing that happened here in Australia. The indigenous people who had been there for many thousands of years were overtaken by force by the colonizers, which in the case of Chile and most of South America were the Spaniards, who came looking for, you know, gold and other resources, which they found quite easily because they're very mineral rich and resource rich countries, especially Chile, which is still actually one of the main sources of industry in Chile, the mining industry.
You have a very strong connection to country. Living in the city in Santiago, I'm just curious how you developed that love of country and trees and nature.
So before we moved to Australia, I was actually living in a little country town, which is where my parents were originally working and where they had met and where my grandmother and auntie, my great aunt, lived.
So it was different. It wasn't in Santiago. It was a different place.
Okay. No, that's right. Yeah, later on, after we moved to Australia, my aunties and uncle, they were in Santiago for work mostly. So the majority of the Chilean population does live in the city. My love for nature actually was developed here in Australia because my father he just adored the Australian landscape and the vastness and the expanse of it. So almost every weekend he would take us camping when we were little. And so that's really where I developed my love for nature. My father instilled that in me. He gave us the opportunities time and time again to just explore and have our, you know, bare feet on the ground and spend the whole day at the beach. You know, Great Ocean Road in Victoria was one of our go-tos. Every summer we'd spend most of the summer either at Lawn or Torquay.
Beautiful. They're very beautiful places.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you moved to Australia, like how old were you? Five or four?
I was four when we arrived. So I was born in 1969 and arrived in September of 1973, which was just around the time of the military coup in Chile.
And did you, when you came, you wouldn't have gone into prep. You would have gone to did you go to kindergarten, or your mum kept you at home, or what happened?
Actually, I did go straight into prep. So I was
Okay.
four. Yeah, I was four when I started grade prep. And I went to a very strict Catholic school, which was run by nuns called St. Joseph's in Springvale.
I went to one of them in Victoria,
Oh, did you?
in Horsham, in the same era. We're the
Oh
same
my
age.
goodness. So you know, yeah, those
I
nuns
had nuns. My grade prep teacher was like an 80-year-old Irish nun or
were
something.
Irish. Oh wow. Was she scary?
Well,
Or was
she
she
wasn't
nice?
too mean, but to me, but to the poor kids who, there were a couple of kids who were disadvantaged people, like, sort of disabilities. She was very nasty to them. They used to get the cut cane all the time,
Wow.
mean.
Those were the days of the canings and the ruler slappings and the
Yeah, the
duster
rulers,
throwings.
the dusters. I remember them well. But yeah, back to you. So you went to a strict Catholic school called St. Joseph's.
The nuns were very stern. They weren't, it wasn't a lot of, physical abuse going on, but enough to, note at this point in time, there's, that kind of stuff isn't happening anymore. But I was put into a Catholic school because that's mostly what South Americans are most the time anyway. I don't think that's the case anymore, but through the Spanish Catholic Church played a very strong role in the Latin American countries. So it was just expected that I would be a Catholic girl.
And you mentioned to me that there was a little bit of confusion with some of the kids, and you had dark skin because you'd been out in the sun and
Oh,
getting
right.
brown.
Yes. Okay. So I, because my parents, they took whatever work was offered to them. They were very, very, very hardworking people. And so we used, we I moved schools probably about seven times.
Really?
Yeah, so one of the schools that I went to was in Dandenong, and that was Dandenong West Primary School. And at the time I was in, I think it was grade 3 and 4. And at that time in the history of Australia, there weren't a lot of immigrants. There had been a wave of Greek, Italian, and Yugoslav, but at the time I don't remember many Asians being around at all. And but there was a main brown-skinned people were the Aboriginal people. And so because of my Indigenous heritage, my skin can tan very, very easily. So my skin was actually very, very, very dark. The Aboriginal kids were very much ostracized by the rest, the other kids. They were bullied and harassed. They weren't at school much. Like out of 5 days, they might be at school 1 or 2 days, and a lot of the time they wouldn't speak in English, or they couldn't speak in English. I remember they would stay together during lunch times in the bike shelter and just stay together and huddle together during those break times, because what would happen was the white kids would actually throw apple cores and banana peels at them, and even empty drink cans for no reason, and call them all sorts of terrible names, just horrible names. And the kids just sort of took it on the chin. It was really, I never saw any of them retaliate the whole time as I was at that school. And there came a time, I suppose, where they just stopped coming. By the time I left the school, they had stopped coming to school. So I'm not sure what happened to them, but I do often think back to them and wonder, where they are and what happened. But that was just terrible. And so what was happening was that I was getting confused as an Aboriginal child. I had, well, obviously my hair was black, my skin was very dark, and I had, dark brown eyes. So the kids, I suppose, confused me and would do the same thing to me. I didn't take it on the chin though, and I would get in trouble at times because I would fight back. I would, if I was getting pushed and had things thrown at me, I would stand up for myself. And what was quite bizarre to me at the time was that teachers would see what was happening and they would just walk past. They would just leave the kids to their own devices and they would not step in. This happened quite a number of times where teachers who were on duty in the playground would just look and then turn away and walk away instead of intervening.
Racism at its best.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, it's hard to know where that came from. I don't know whether that was instilled by parents or whether it's just part of human nature. I've wondered about that, that doesn't accept what's different.
And I remember growing up I was in rural Victoria, so I was in Horsham. And I remember family members calling Aboriginal people Abos. It was they were very, very marginalised, and you hardly ever saw Aboriginal people in our town. I don't remember any Aboriginal people at my school. Sometimes I wonder if those couple of kids that were in our class that the nun, Sister Dara, took her, she wasn't kind to. I wonder if one of those girls might have been Aboriginal. I don't know. It's racism. Racism. And we were raised with that.
It's very tragic, you know. I'd like to understand that a little bit more from an anthropological point of view, possibly, or a psychological point of view. Every country has some level of racism going on, and you know, fortunately, we've moved so far from that actual physical abuse that was happening towards people, but it is still a covert. You know, it's not an overt racism, or at times it is, but it's still there. Like I still notice in my own life, there's things that happen where being stared at or being asked where I'm from, you know, I mean, not that that's offensive at all, being asked where I'm from. It's just obviously when you look different, when you look ethnic, people are curious and they're trying to be friendly sometimes, and that's perfectly fine. I don't think that's offensive, but in a way I wonder, is that, you know, also a form of racism or positive racism, I don't know what you call it, where, you know, you look very different and it's pointed out to you that you look different, even though when you're walking around, you don't feel, you just feel like a human being. You don't feel like, you know, you're sticking out like in any way, but when you get reminded that you're not from here, where do you come from? You don't belong here, really, you know, or not in that way, but do you know what I mean?
I do. It's uncomfortable. I've felt it when I've been in other countries.
Yeah.
In some way. It's like you don't belong or you stand out. But in your case, you've been here forever, you know?
Yeah, I grew up
all your life, pretty much.
Exactly. All my schooling, all my uni, everything, worked here all my life. So, but it's like I was saying, it's not something that I take personally. I'm not offended by that at all.
What was it like when you moved to the Sunshine Coast? When did you come here?
It was actually 2000 when I moved up from Melbourne with my four-year-old son. And we lived in Flaxton for about 17 years. And
wow.
It was beautiful because up in Flaxton we just had this absolutely peaceful little cottage on the top of the hill overlooking the entire coast. From when the storms would come in, they were just absolutely spectacular. We had a big window overlooking that whole escarpment down Flaxton. And so my son went to Mapleton Primary School, Mullaney High School for high school, although he did go to Nambour Christian College for a little while as well, the first couple of years of school. So yeah, we were very much you know, He was a Sunshine Coast boy. He learned how to swim at Condalilla Falls Lagoon. We'd be at the beach every weekend, and he'd just spend, you know, the entire day in the water while I read a book on a Sunday. And, you know, it was just totally an Australian upbringing for him. He was born in Australia.
And how was it for you coming to the Sunshine Coast? Did you ever miss Chile, or did you have heart connection to that place that you missed in your life and your world, or not?
You know, I think what happens with so there's a few different kinds of people. I think those who just never really stop pining, and there's those that, like in my case, you have the best of both worlds, and so you're able to bridge both worlds. You've got one foot in each land. You've got one foot in each country, and you're bilingual, so you can move very easily and freely in both cultures and countries. You don't belong to either. You don't belong anywhere, really.
Is that how you feel?
Well, yeah, but it's fine. I feel comfortable with that because I've got a personal ideology about that that's on a spiritual level, where I don't identify with the physical form ultimately, because it's because it is temporary. So yeah, I tend to have a different point of view in that regard. I acknowledge my background and my cultural influences, but yeah, I certainly identify as more as a soul in a transitory body, you know, ultimately. So it really eases that angst of, you know, for me, it's helped to ease that angst of, you know, not belonging anywhere, because I think none of us really belong ultimately. We're only here temporarily in these physical forms. So I enjoyed all the best of what there was, I suppose, when I'd go to Chile, with enjoying the welcome of the family every time I would be there, and the delicious food and feasts that we'd have, and the outings to, you know, lovely places, which is what happens when you're a visitor, you know, somewhere. And then here in Australia, the ease of life, being able to be free to move around as a woman, which is not something that was as easy in Chile or in South American countries.
Is that because of the political situation, or just inherent danger, or just because you are a woman? Why is that?
It's a much more patriarchal culture. So even though here in Australia, I believe that it is still a patriarchal culture, it's much more so in South American countries. There's a lot more expectations on what your behavior should be like as a woman, and how you must dress and look. It's not just the men who maintain that. It's the women who also maintain that. For example, if there's a son born in the family, they seem to get special treatment, you know. The mother will do a lot of the things for him, whereas if there's a daughter, she's expected to learn all the housework pretty much early on and be on par with mum. The boys aren't expected to do that. They're just little things like that where there's inequalities that, you know, thankfully here in Australia we're slowly, you know, moving away from. But yeah, there's things that are acceptable on TV in South America would be completely unacceptable here, you know, on Australian TV.
Wow. Do you think it's changing slowly?
Yes, of course. And because, unfortunately, countries like Chile are becoming highly westernized, and it's had a strong, strong American influence, because it was actually the CIA which installed the dictatorship government. And there was a lot of financial interests that the US had in Chile. The dictatorship under Pinochet worked really well for them to be able to install all those multinationals and the corporations that really have made Chile quite a rich country, but has completely done away with its original culture. And even the siesta and the midday meals have started to disappear.
There was a piece of forest at Steve Owen Way that you were instrumental in saving when that big Caloundra intersection went in. I'm interested from a cultural perspective what that was like. Like, I think that comes back to your connection to country. What made you so driven to be a part of saving that land?
You've hit the nail on the head, Anna. It was my connection to country that really spurred me on to become involved in the first place. There was already a group of people that had already started on that campaign. I came into that at a time where the snowball had just started to roll down the hill, and there was a core group of people who were very, very, very dedicated, and they gave a lot of their personal time, energy and resources for the space of about 7 years. It was interesting to note that there was quite a number of nationalities in that little core group. So there were people from England, New Zealand, myself from Chile. There was Megan and Rex Halverson, which were originally leading the Koala Crusaders group, who came on board with us to support us as well. There was a lot more immigrants had formed this core group of earth defenders than
and a couple of First Nations Aboriginal people as well.
Yes, that's true.
Uncle Alan?
Yes, Uncle Alan was very instrumental. He was part of the core group.
And Auntie Bridget was a bit involved as well, wasn't
she? Yes, she was. And others that were from the Cubby Cubby were very instrumental in helping us to actually secure this area of land, given the title of National Forest. But that was a long, long process. And if anyone's interested in having a look at how that all happened, there's a Wix website that was put together with one of the core members or some of the core members of the group called Save Your Steve Owen Way Forest. even just a small group of people coming together could affect change to that degree. And that was a significant win for the Sunshine Coast, because what was at stake was the loss of many, many, many hectares of very, very valuable habitat for wildlife, birds, vegetation, trees that were in there. Some of them were actually listed as, you know, rare and vulnerable species. That was such a significant event. So the Sunshine Coast Environment Council was very key. It gained a lot of attention in the media. Very serendipitous that at the time we had a change of government. So I suppose it was, all the pieces came together. It was just like one of these things that I think was just guided. Really, we were guided. And Uncle Alan, will tell you how many things happened that were just unexplainable miracles all along the way. And it was so lovely that he actually came on board and became part of this, because he was able to add that Indigenous element.
But living on the Sunshine Coast, did you ever feel like a migrant?
I love being a migrant on the Sunshine Coast, to tell you the truth, because I was able to be invited to teach Spanish at the university. So I'm actually an interpreter translator by profession. I worked as a medical interpreter for about 20 years. And what happened was that they were looking for Spanish teachers and tutors at the uni and at TAFE. So I applied and got the work straight away. So I was working during the day as a medical interpreter, and then in the evenings teaching Spanish at the university and at TAFE. I'd run short courses a few times a year, and that was just fantastic, because people were just so eager to learn Spanish, and I was able to teach it in a way that made it fun, you know, for everyone. And they ended up being able to go traveling, which was why most people would learn Spanish. They wanted to travel to South America and Spain. And so, yeah, I was able to give them some travel tips having been there. And
what have you learned about yourself that might be helpful for others?
I think the non-identification aspect, I think, for me has been the most helpful thing for me as a person, that, you know, people will perceive you in all sorts of different ways. And I've had that, like I mentioned to you, I used to be called, Black Abbo from when I was, you know, 6 years old, when I knew that, you know, that wasn't my culture, and, you know, it wasn't something that I found offensive. It was the physical abuse that was the negative thing. Other people's perception of you is not, you know, is something to acknowledge and accept and allow to be without, you know, taking offense, you know, or, you know, because it's not who you are. Like, being very secure in who you are as a person is more important, you know, than how other people perceive you. So it doesn't just apply in the cultural sense, it applies, you know, just overall. But because you're continuously being reminded that you are ethnic, then, you know, it's something that you can just practice often, where you accept that somebody perceives you, you know, in a certain way, just be okay with that. And I'm not saying that in a negative way, because often, you know, people remark on my hair, on my skin color, you know, on my thick eyebrows, or on my facial features, and they say it in a positive way. You know, they're curious. You know, they would like to know what that cultural heritage background is. You know, and that's fine.
And where do you draw your strength, Carolita? You're a strong woman. I know that you're always involved in environmental campaigns and working in community. You're at a school now.
Spending time in nature, in a nutshell, just being able to ground bare feet on the ground, you know, as little clothes as possible in the sunshine, and gardening, I suppose, you know, in the process as well. Being close to animals, that they're all things that are very strengthening to me. They're very healing. Spending time around old trees, there's just something. I can't really explain it. It's just whatever anxiety or angst or confusion or whatever, you know, emotional turmoil I might be in or may not be in, you know, it's noticeable when I have been in some kind of emotional turmoil where I've spent time in nature, and that's been completely just taken away. There's without any effort, you know, no effort on my part, just walking around in a forest, with just a little bit of time to spend in that space is enough to completely recalibrate my mind and my emotions to, you know, just something that that's peaceful, you know, and where I have answers to, you know, whatever things are, have been in my mind or heart.
I get that.
Yeah.
Just I think going a lot for of people, a walk in nature, yeah, in the forest, it takes it away. You can be in a bad mood and come out the other end and it's all dissipated.
Exactly. So it's not unique to me. It's just, yeah, that answer, that's you know, a very, very clear answer for me because it's been such a strong mode of healing for me, effortless mode of healing.
Which makes it all the better.
Yeah. Yeah.
If there's one thing that people should know about you, what would that be?
You know what? I think I'm staying on the topic because the strong connection that I feel to the earth and trees, I think looking back into my ancestry, the people, the Pehuenche people, Mapuche people, Pehuenche people, they call themselves after the tree. So Pehuen is the tree, which we know in scientific or Latin terms as Araucaria araucana, which the sister tree actually is the Araucaria bidwillii, which is the Australian bunya pine. So as I was saying earlier, those two trees grew side by side in the Araucanian region of Chile, which is where they originated from during the time of back in the time of Gondwana. When I first realized this, it was like, wow, I was just awestruck when I realized that I'm actually in a land that was once connected to my original land, not separated by half a globe, which it is now. The both countries were at one point connected. They've drifted apart to polar opposite sides of the equator, you know, with all the cataclysmic events that have happened on Earth, all the seismic activity and volcanic activity, you know, it's all shifted the tectonic plates. But at one time, the two continents were united in some form of idealized, you know, way. I consider myself as still, you know, in that space of being part of both lands, you know, not being displaced from my homeland, but seeing this as part of my homeland as well, just in a different era. So, and those trees, just going back to what the crux of this is those trees are those sentinels, those standing fossil sentinels, the living fossil sentinels of that time, and symbolizing the unity between the two countries, Chile and Australia. You know, I feel that there is, you know, a much longer and deeper story than just now.
Have you got bunyas on your property now?
I have actually. I've got really old bunya here on my property.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they grow very slow. You know they're old because
they almost look like elephants' legs sometimes. I think, you know, sometimes you see elephants' legs with like skin that's a bit saggy.
Yeah, and you know, I heard someone who knows about the history of trees speaking the other day was saying that because of the era that these trees came from, there was a lot of volcanic activity. There was, you know, very, very harsh climatic conditions, and so the bark of the Araucaria species were very, very you know, thick, and in order to protect the tree itself from you know, the impacts of volcanic activity and the snow. What's happening at the moment, unfortunately, though, the reality is that because of changed climatic conditions that we have now, the Araucaria trees are in a lot of danger because they were not designed to withstand this level of heat and dryness. Very few forests remaining now of the Araucarias. Forestry companies are burning native forests in Chile in order to just do away with the old growth forests or the native forests in order to plant their, you know, paper bark plantations. And yeah, there's not many people that can stand up to defend them, because what happens when you stand up as an environmentalist is that it, you know, you're pretty much flagging yourself as someone to be gotten rid of. You know, you're just in the way, you're stymieing financial gain. So, you know, for for those who have power. So
that's distressing and tragic. And
yes, but
awful.
We're not powerless. You know, banyan trees have seeds, but when trees have seeds, and we can plant them, we can try and grow forests. You know, if we all were to plant a tree, you know, we would really. I mean, I plant heaps of trees because I'm president of a conservation group called Friends of the Forest, and so very regularly I gather together volunteers to come and help me weed native forests and plant native trees.
It's easy, isn't it? We have it here on the Sunshine Coast. There's lots of bush care groups. I'm a part of one too. And we look after some bush just around our house in Nambour, up at Nambour Heights. And
it's a fun thing to do as a community, as a group. Yeah, you develop friendships, you meet new people. It's perfect exercise. You don't have to go to the gym, just do some planting of trees and gardening, weeding. Wow,
feels great afterwards.
Fresh air, exactly. Really, you're in the fresh air and sunshine. You feel fantastic.
I think we're at the end of our time together today, beautiful Carolita. Did you have any final comments?
I just wanted to thank you. You're really opening up, you know, the world for a lot of people by discussing these things. You know, it can be very confronting to hear some things, and you know, it could open up a whole lot of other discussions. And I'm free to talk to anyone. I'm easily contacted through the Friends of the Forest page. If anyone wanted to go on that on Facebook, there's a group there where we discuss all sorts of things. But if anything comes up for anyone after this conversation, you know, it might be, you know, triggering for some people, and I'm happy to, you know, just come alongside if anyone does want to chat about those things.
Now, you told me how to say see you soon in Spanish, something like hasta luego. How do you say?
Hasta luego. Hasta luego.
Hasta luego.
Got
hasta
it.
Hasta luego.
Yay. Hasta luego, amiga.
Amiga, what's amiga?
Friend.
Oh,
friend.
That's beautiful. Okay, well, thank you, and we'll see you again soon. Thank you, Carolita.
Thank you, Anna. Hope to see you soon. After this conversation, you know, it might be, you know, triggering for some people, and I'm happy to, you know, just come alongside if anyone does want to chat about those things.
Now, you told me how to say see you soon in Spanish, something like hasta luego. How do you say?
Hasta luego. Hasta luego.
Hasta luego.
Got
hasta
it.
Luego.
Yay. Hasta luego, amiga.
Amiga, what's amiga?
Friend.
Oh, friend. That's